Robert Stinnett, author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor, and about what the U.S. government knew about the attack on Pearl Harbor and how it would happen. Stay tuned for that. We're going to start with a little bit of a different theme this morning. Stay tuned for Veterans Voice. Wrong track.
So this is Christmas, and what have you done? Another year over, and a new one just begun. And so this is Christmas, I hope you have fun. The
Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, and 100.7 FM in Albany, Corvallis, Eugene, or on the World Wide Web at KBOO.FM. I'm Marvin, along with Mr. Bill.
Good morning.
And Arlene's not here today, but she'll be back next month. She didn't want to drive in the snow and the sleet over this hill she had to come over. So I understand that. But she'll be back. She'll be back. And we'll, part of our show, she's an important part. Today we're going to be talking with Robert B. Stinnett. He's the author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. Mr. Stinnett is a World War II Navy veteran. And he's a retired journalist and photographer for the Oakland Tribune. He's also a consultant for BBC and for Asahi and NHK televisions in Japan on the war in the Pacific. So we'll be talking to him in just a little bit. But I want to, there's a few things I want to talk about a little bit before we get started here about some veterans issues. Of the 300,000 Americans who served in World War One, Bill, 20 years after the war, before World War II started, there was still 50,000 veterans in mental hospitals for war-related trauma.
That doesn't surprise
me. Yeah, 50,000 soldiers were still in mental hospitals 20 years after World War One ended. And that's just unbelievable. And also for you Vietnam vets, I got to, there's this guy back in 1971 in Saigon. His real name, I can't remember his real name, but he went by David Rabbit. And he started an underground radio station in Saigon. He did it in a he and another guy and a woman that was Air Force was in the Air Force. She was in the Air Force also, the three of them. And he started this radio station in a house of ill repute in Saigon. They rented a room there so they could do their radio show. They were so unhappy with what was coming out of Armed Forces Radio that they just wanted to do something different. And so they played a lot of real great music that Armed Forces Radio wouldn't play. It was called First Termers Radio. And you can go on the internet and you can hear some of it. It's really amazing. And they only did 30 shows before they it got too hot for them, and they closed down after 30 shows. And there's only one show left. The rest of them had been lost and destroyed, but they had one other shows left. And you can hear that on YouTube. You can go on YouTube or on the net, and you can put in First Termers Radio or Dave Rabbit. And it's just amazing what these guys did. It was just hilarious, you know. Underground radio station in Saigon during the war. So they some of the stuff they say, the white rabbit, you know, the white rabbit and stuff. It's just amazing. I wish they could have went on. And also 99 years ago in World War One, the British and the German troops on Christmas Eve stopped shooting. They stopped fighting each other, and they got out of their trenches, and they celebrated Christmas together. They played soccer. They shared food. They traded trinkets. They just talked to each other. And, you know, this was right in the middle of one of the bloodiest conflicts we've had. And officers didn't want them to do it. They tried to stop them from doing it, but they couldn't. It just got out, you know, flooded it, and these guys got out and started talking to each other, and it was just amazing. You should go. You can also get that stuff on the internet and read about how the British and the German soldiers in World War One got out of their trenches and talked to each other on Christmas, but then they got back in, and they went at it again, so... It's just a horrible thing what happened to those guys. And like I said, 50,000 American veterans were in mental hospitals after the war. After 20 years after the war, they were still in mental hospitals. And also something I found on the internet was after World War II, the Veterans Administration used lobotomies on about 2,000 veterans as a treatment for mental disorders. 2,000 veterans were lobotomized because they thought that would help them with their war traumas. So that's just unbelievable that they would even think that. But that's what they did back then, didn't they?
There was a guy that specialized in lobotomies, and he carried with him, a lobotomy is done with a ice pick or a screwdriver up and behind the eye.
Ooh.
And this guy carried this sterling silver tool that he used to do his lobotomies with.
He carried it with him?
He carried it with him,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, man. Ooh. Boy, you know, out of World War II, World War One, there came some, like, Sassoon and some of those great writers, you know. After World War II, you know, you had Mailer and Heller and those folks writing stuff. And then Vietnam, you had some great stories after came out of Vietnam, you know.
Yeah.
World War II, you know, All Quiet on the Western Front.
Willie and Joe.
Yeah, there was some great stuff came out of that, you know, out of that horrors of
Bill Malden.
Yeah, yeah, just amazing stuff came out of the wars. And now our brothers and sisters in these filthy Gulf wars, they're writing. They're going to be writing and saying things. So,
well, they're going to have a lot to talk about because the Defense Appropriations Bill carries with it a cut in veterans' pensions and benefits.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
I was listening to that this morning as I was coming. I knew it was
coming.
Coming.
Yeah.
So I was listening to a short discussion about that. It's not supposed to take effect until 2016, I believe, but they're seriously considering it. But the people that were discussing it thought that perhaps it wouldn't ever come into law because there was so much public
outrage
against cutting benefits for veterans.
For war veterans, yeah. Well, I can see that. You know, that's one of the things that got, yeah, well, it's a sad state of affairs, you know. Sad state of affairs. Like I said, we're going to talk to Robert B. Stinnett on his book, Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. There's a lot of really interesting things I read in this book. I'm sure it raised a lot of controversy within the community, World War II community, by some of the stuff he says. But he documents, the book is really well documented, and it's just a really good book to read, you know. And if you look back on the history of the United States, how it's gotten in these wars, you know, you look at the Gulf of Tonkin, you know,
weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, weapons of mass destruction. You look at Remember the Maine.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the war to end all wars. You know, they, you know, stuff like that. But I'm sure the book
Manifest Destiny.
Oh yeah, Manifest Destiny. I'm sure. We'll talk to Mr. Stinnett about some of the pushback he's gotten on his book. I saw the book on the internet, and I got on the internet and looked up his name, and found like three or four phone numbers for Oakland, California. So I started calling them, and a couple of them were, you know, they didn't work anymore. And so the last one I got, I called, and Mr. Stinnett answered the phone, and we talked, and he agreed to be on our show, and I really appreciate that. And good morning, Mr. Stinnett.
Good morning to you, Marvin.
It's good to hear you. Like I was talking about your book, you served in the Navy from 42 to 46. Is that right?
Yes, that's right, in the Pacific, on the aircraft carriers.
On an aircraft carrier. Wow. Wow, amazing. So you saw what was going on, didn't you?
Well, after I got into the Navy in December 1942,
mm-hmm.
and then we arrived in the Pacific in 1944.
Wow, amazing, amazing. So you worked, like I was telling the folks, you worked for the Oakland Tribune. You were a journalist and a photographer, and you when you retired from that then you started working on your book. How long did it take you to write this book?
Well, I first learned about the U.S. Navy cryptography in 1982 when I read a book called At Dawn We Slept, and that was the first I'd heard that we had a monitor station in Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. And that rang a bell, and I went to my editor and said, this would make a good story. What about going over and checking it out?
Mm-hmm.
So I filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Navy, and they let me see the monitor station.
Wow.
And there I met cryptographers who told me I could find out more about their interception of the Japanese Navy.
Yeah, the intercepts of Japanese Navy. And one of the things, even to this day, I have a friend, Mr. Stinnett, who in Vietnam, he did that kind of work, and he was filing for disability through the Veterans Administration, and he wrote to get some information from the CIA and from the NSA, because that's who he worked for. And he got this, both of them sending back things, we can either confirm or deny that this happened, what you want to know. We can, you know, they just wouldn't tell him. So I'm sure you got a lot of that when you started filing for freedom of information on code breaking.
Oh, yes, you're absolutely right. I started filing immediately as soon as I read about it and learned about it. Though the Navy, to their credit, they did let me, they confirmed that there was a station at Pearl Harbor called Station Hypo.
Yeah, Hypo.
And so that was the station that I was allowed to see and take photographs of. And we in the Oakland Tribune, we ran the story for the Pearl Harbor anniversary of December 7th, 1982.
Mm-hmm. Did you get to talk to any of the people in the cryptology area, the listening post, who were there before the attack on Pearl Harbor? Did you get to talk to any of those people? Or are they still alive?
Yes. That was in 1982. There were many of them, the cryptographers were alive, and some of them were docents at the USS Arizona Memorial in Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And so I met them, and they told me about how they intercepted the Japanese naval radio messages, and that where I could find them. And so that set me on this search. But it took about 15 years to get that information.
Oh, I'm sure it did. So did any of them feel? Well, let me. It's something that always bothered me, and you talk about it in your book, and the stuff that what we heard growing up is that the Americans had only broken the diplomatic codes; they hadn't broken the military codes, and you prove that they did before. The attack on Pearl Harbor, that they were reading those messages, both diplomatic and military. Is that true?
Yes, yeah, that is correct, Marvin. The U.S. Army cryptographers had broken the Japanese diplomatic code, and the U.S. Navy cryptographers had broken the Japanese naval code. The Japanese call it Code Book D. Like it is in dog.
Uh-huh.
And they were reading that and other codes that the Japanese Navy used. And so we were able to locate them by radio direction finders because they broke radio silence. That's another fable the Japanese Navy was on radio silence. They weren't. They did break it when they were in the North Pacific, and we had declared, meaning the United States had declared the North Pacific a vacant sea.
Hmm.
By that, they meant we were to have no U.S. or allied forces in the North Pacific and permit the Japanese Hawaii force full sailing without any interruption, because President Roosevelt wanted to end the isolation movement in this country. That was the whole purpose, was to get Japan to make a dastardly attack on the United States and get American support for the war.
Yeah, but
World War II at that time.
Yeah, because World War II, I mean, the United States after World War I, boy, there was really an isolationist movement where the people in the United States did not want to send their sons and daughters and nieces and nephews into another war because they remembered the bloodshed in World War One, and they just didn't want to do it. And so they had to come up with a way to get the American people on their side, to get them to go to war.
That's right. The Americans wanted nothing to do with what they called Europe's war.
Mm-hmm.
We had loaned them money, and the British and other members of our allied in World War One, mm-hmm. they didn't repay the bills.
Yeah,
and plus all of the deaths and terrible injuries.
Yeah.
And at that time, the isolationist became an epithet, a bad word. Somebody that was an isolationist wasn't patriotic and didn't understand what was going on.
Yeah. There's in your book, Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor, there's somebody I want to talk to you about, and I couldn't understand what this guy, why he did what he did, and that's McCollum.
Yes, that's Arthur McCollum.
Yeah, talk about him. I don't understand where he was coming from, because he had lived in Japan, he spoke Japanese, and he came up with this 8 steps to get them to go to war, the Japanese to go to war. I couldn't understand what was behind his thinking, Mr. Stinnett. What was he coming from? What was his whole thinking?
Well, Commander McCollum was head of the Far East Intelligence Desk of the United States Navy in 1940 and 1941. And he could speak fluent Japanese and knew of their culture and was making recommendations to overcome the isolation movement in this country. This was in 1940 when he made this proposal to the U.S. Navy, and then eventually it reached President Roosevelt, and the President discussed it in the Oval Office. But McCollum, prior to being the head of the Far East Desk, had been assigned to a European U.S. Navy task force that was listening in to German warships and the Luftwaffe that were supporting the civil war in Spain, and so they were learning how to how the radio frequencies used by Germany, and so he feared that Germany was going to come over and attack the United States, because at the time when he wrote this memo, there was constant bombing by the Germans of London, and they were amassing invasion forces on the English Channel. They had conquered France and most of Europe at the time. So he had all this, he was listening in to the German radio frequencies, and so he was really telling President Roosevelt, let's start listening in to the Japanese frequencies. Mm-hmm. That's a simple deal, but it's more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because by what I was reading in your book is that by 1936, they had already were listening. Was it 1936 after 1936 that these listening posts in Hong Kong and Corregidor and where else was it? Hawaii and Seattle. Seattle was one of the listening posts.
Monitor stations on the Pacific Basin from San Diego north to San Francisco, Seattle, Dutch Harbor, Alaska, and then down on the in Manila at Corregidor, and we were linked with the British, who also had monitor stations.
Mm-hmm. And they also had who else was it you talk about? The Dutch? Was it the Dutch?
Yes, the Dutch, the Netherlands.
Yeah, the Netherlands.
Government, they were very industrious in it. So they were the Dutch, the English, and the Americans were all listening in, and there were about 25 monitor stations, mm-hmm. and they were exchanging the information.
So they were all exchanging and comparing, and they so. From what I understand from your book is that the Japanese fleet was off the coast of Indochina before they headed for Hawaii. Is that am I right?
No, there were two. Let's call them task forces. One was the invasion forces of Japan that were aimed at Southeast Asia, and then the Hawaii force. It was a force to knock out the American fleet so they could not come to the rescue in Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
That was the strategy at the time.
Mm-hmm. So on that, when McCollum had the 8-step program, can you talk about the 8-step program to get Japan to attack the United States? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. Commander McCollum proposed 8 provocations that he said that if we put them in place, then Japan would commit an overt act of war against the United States. And so there were 8 of them. One of them was to keep the United States fleet based in Hawaii. Another was to send American cruiser task forces into Japanese territorial waters that would tick off the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And others was to cut off their supply of oil and steel and that sort of thing for making a war. And also to give support to China, which Japan was had attacked during this time frame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he seemed to have the ear of Franklin Roosevelt, where nobody else did. And he just an enigma. I just can't figure out, you know, what this guy was coming from. Reading the book, you know, I'm still thinking, boy, this guy, I don't know. But I want to talk. Go ahead.
He was born in Japan because his parents were missionaries in Nagasaki, Japan.
Ooh.
And so he learned his first language was Japanese and their culture. It's the same thing the culture would be. Suppose Japanese task forces came up there in Oregon around Astoria and the Columbia River and in Puget Sound. That would tick off America.
Oh, yeah.
Well, mm-hmm. And that's what he thought would happen if we sent task forces in the Japanese territory, and that's what it did.
Mm-hmm.
The nationalist movement in Japan, they reacted immediately to all this and started planning for the Pearl Harbor attack.
Yeah, one of the things that you talk about is even though there was an embargo on oil and embargo on scrap metal to Japan, there were still ships leaving the West Coast, taking oil and scrap metal to Japan. They just seemed to just ignore the embargo, and they were still sending the oil and stuff to Japan. Was this planned? Did they just say we're not going to look at it? We're just going to let them have it?
That's right. We did have rules that we couldn't send them like a certain octane of gasoline.
Mm.
You couldn't get, say, 87, but you could get 85. So they played these kind of games. And so Japanese tankers were filling up with oil here in the San Francisco Bay Area and taking, and also from Los Angeles, and taking them, taking the oil to the refineries in Japan.
Yeah.
But they were given enough oil to last until about 1943.
Hmm.
And at that time, President Roosevelt knew that our two-ocean navy would be in effect and would be able to take on the Japanese, mm-hmm. and that's what happened.
Yeah. Also, why did they, the government, why did they decide to move the Pacific Fleet out of the West Coast and put them in Hawaii? Because Hawaii was not defendable. They didn't have the infrastructure to take care of the amount of ships that were going to be there. But they moved them from the West Coast to Hawaii. And there were some admirals that were dead set against this. They did not want that to happen because they knew they couldn't support them. But they went ahead and did it. Why did they do that?
You're absolutely right, Marvin. The admiral in charge of the it was called the United States Fleet at the time, and he met with the president in the Oval Office, and they had a knockdown, drag-out fight there, and because the president wanted to adopt the McCollum memo, of having a lure to the Japanese fleet. And the Pacific Fleet was moved 2,000 miles, almost 3,000 miles, from the mainland U.S. there to Hawaii, and they're much closer to Japan. So that was a lure to Japan to attack us at Pearl Harbor and then ignite the American people, the outrage of such a thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I just thinking about that, you know, there's just that infrastructure for Hawaii at the time they moved them was just no way they could have supported those or protect those ships. There's just no way. And at the time on Hawaii, there was Admiral Kimmel and General Short, and they really took the brunt after the attack on Pearl Harbor, these two men. Did they know anything about what was going on? Did they have any idea? Did they get to see the intercepts? Were they in on, you know, did they know anything about the upcoming attack?
Well, this is the strange thing. Both General Short and Admiral Kimmel had monitor stations on Oahu. That's the main island, mm-hmm. of Hawaii, and that's where the Navy had the Pacific Fleet anchored on December the 7th. But you see, when the Japanese Hawaii force departed Japan on November 25th, they were in radio contact with one another as they moved through the North Pacific, or the vacant sea, and we picked up the radio transmissions and with radio direction finders located them in the North Pacific. And Admiral Kimmel was told about that and sent a warning to Washington, but he received orders back that from President Roosevelt saying that he wanted them to stand aside and let Japan commit the first overt act. Mm. And that's printed in my book.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that order.
Yeah. You're listening to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland. And we're talking with Robert B. Stinnett. He is the author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. His book is filled with footnotes, and it's filled with things that he got. Like, Mr. Stinnett, there's some photographs or pictures of some of the intercepted messages. And he had one that was really interesting to me, if I can find it here. It was there was two different ones. One they sent out that people could read, and the other one that really showed everything. It wasn't blacked out, and it showed where it was from and everything. Did you get a lot of those kind of things that had all been blacked out so you couldn't see who they came from and who they were going to on those intercepts?
Yes, the Navy records, they were all kept, and they're in the National Archives in Washington D.C. So your listeners can see it for themselves if they go back there, and that's what I did. And at first, they did black out the fact that we had broken the Japanese code. But I had learned that was not true, and so I filed another Freedom of Information Act request to see the original, you know, that did not have the blackout, and that's what you're talking about.
Right.
They're in the book. I showed where they had blocked out the code book D messages.
Yeah, they'd blocked those all out, but you got the original, so you could see exactly what was going on. And I want to get back to Admiral Kimmel and General Short. Now, both of these guys were out of the loop. They weren't getting some of the information that they needed for their to protect their sailors and soldiers on Hawaii. And do you think that it was planned that these men, these commanders of all this, not to get those messages?
Well, you see, the monitor station for Admiral Kimmel was called Station Hypo, and they he got a daily, Admiral Kimmel got a daily summary of all the messages. And on November 25th, he got the messages that the Japanese fleet, the Hawaii fleet, was in the North Pacific and coming eastbound, in other words, towards the United States or Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent that to Washington, but he received the answer back was, the United States desires that Japan commit the first act. Stand aside and let them fire the first shot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's right in my book.
I know.
Read that yourself.
Yeah. So what did they do to Short? I mean, Short, the same thing. Short says he
had... also had an Army monitor station on Oahu and received similar information. But they're both following the orders of their commander-in-chief,
right,
who was President Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, the president saw the danger. If we don't take on Germany, he wanted to attack Germany, but as I said earlier, Americans wanted nothing to do with Europe's war, and even though the German submarines were sinking our warships and tankers in the Atlantic Ocean, it didn't arouse the American public.
Mm-hmm.
But when Japan attacked us at Pearl Harbor, we certainly did. Immediate reaction, and Congress declared war the next day.
The next day, yeah. What was the splendid arrangement?
The splendid arrangement was the term used by the Chief of Naval Operations. And that was the arrangement of radio intercept stations in the Pacific. Those 25 stations that were intercepting the Japanese naval dispatches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was really. I mean, people, if they want to really get what we're talking about here, is they should read your book. It really says a lot of interesting things. I mean, one of the things that I didn't know that you wrote in your book, and this was, I think, as early as August 10th, 1936, Roosevelt had circulated a secret memorandum declaring, "Every Japanese citizen or non-citizen on the island of Oahu who meets these Japanese ships or who has any connection with their officers and men should be secretly but definitely identified and his or her name placed on a special list of those who would be the first to be placed in concentration camps in the event of trouble. And that is 1936.
That is right, and that's what happened in 1942 when Japanese Americans were locked up in camps here in the mainland. Yeah. It happened to Japanese Americans in the state of Washington, Oregon, and California.
Yeah,
transferred to the concentration camps.
Bill, did we have one of those camps here in Oregon?
I don't recall.
I don't either, but I know that they took a lot of people from here in Portland away.
There was a large Japanese community here.
Yeah, and they took them away and put them in these camps. Go ahead.
They were all innocent. They didn't do anything.
They did nothing, Mr. Stinnett.
That's right.
They were citizens.
There was a Japanese naval spy hidden in the Japanese consulate in Honolulu. He was the one that was sending bomb plots back to the Japanese Navy in Tokyo, and he also was reporting that there were no barrage balloons up around Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
So anybody that knows wartime, you have barrage balloons up, your aircraft can't fly through the barrage balloons because they'd crash. But there were none put up, and there were no torpedo nets around the battleships. However, the most modern warships were all taken out of Pearl Harbor about a week before the attack.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
The only ones that were really sunk were the relics of World War One, which could only go about 18 knots. And so all of our carriers and their task forces were out of Pearl Harbor on December 7th.
Wow. I didn't know that. I had no idea. What was really interesting in your book, you talk about the people who worked on breaking these codes, and how hard they worked and everything they had to do to break these codes, and then they broke them, which was so interesting. But the big code breakers were women. There were two women. Agnes Meyer Driscoll, she was one of the women that was like one of the best code breakers they had.
Yes, she was the brilliant Navy code breaker, and she was in World War One. She started in the Navy cryptography section, but she was an enlisted person. Women could not go beyond an enlisted rank in the Navy at that time. And so she went in so she could get paid and continue her work. They hired her as a civilian. Mm-hmm. So she was the chief civilian cryptographer for the Navy and broke the Japanese code. They changed it about every 3 years. And so she broke the one that was used at Pearl Harbor, she had broken it by 1940, and so we were able to read it. And then she turned over all of the details to the cryptographers in the Pacific.
Was she the one? Did she break the 5-num code?
Yeah, she's the one that first broke the 5-number code, which the Japanese called code book T, and the Americans called it the 5-number code.
Was that military code or was that diplomatic code?
That was a military code. That was the Japanese main operation code for their Navy. All of the orders went out on code book T.
And they broke that in 1940.
Yeah, that's right.
Why do you think, Mr. Stinnett, Why do you think forever that the government has always said that the United States had not broke the military codes, but they had broke the diplomatic codes? To this day, have they admitted that they broke the five-number code? They've always said they didn't.
That is right, but the records in National Archives, they were all labeled top secret until I started filing Freedom of Information Act, and they hadn't released that or go to court, and I would enforce them to do it. But the Navy, to their credit, they did release those records to me, and they are, and your readers, listeners reading the book, you can see them, and they're in the book.
Yeah, I looked at them and I read them, and it's just amazing. One of the things that you talked about in your book is about Edward R. Murrow, and I thought that was so interesting. He was a CBS News correspondent. He was a wonderful correspondent, and he had a meeting following Pearl Harbor attack. It was him. It was Edward R. Murrow and a general, I think, or somebody, and he had met at a dinner party with the president, and I think his wife, and what was talked about between Edward R. Murrow, the president, and this general or aide or whoever it was, really upset Murrow. And you say that to this day he never said what they talked about. Can you talk a little bit about that meeting?
Yeah, so that is a very vital meeting. It was held at midnight on December 7th to the 8th in the White House. And it included the president and Edward R. Murrow, and then William Donovan.
Yeah, Donovan.
The founder of the CIA. And the president wanted to know whether they thought that the Japanese attack would unify the country. And both Murrow and Donovan said that they were certain that the country would be unified, and that they would really go to war and start World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Murrow did not want to confirm that. But Donovan does confirm that in his writings.
Yeah, boy, that must have just got the... I mean, go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, as I recall, at that time there was a Japanese diplomat negotiating in Washington, trying to... smooth things over, apparently, I forget his name. Nakamura, was it, or
Nomura?
Yeah,
it was Ambassador Nomura.
Uh huh.
He also had an assistant, but they were sent here because Japan really did not want to go to war against the United States. They were not ready for it, and they knew they would lose it in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were trying to call off the troops, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
But the president wanted to end the isolation movement where he recognized that Germany was the real culprit in the war.
Yeah.
That if they defeated British forces and got a hold of the British fleet and merged it with the Nazi Navy, they could come over here and seize British possessions like at Bermuda, Canada, and in the Caribbean, and then invade the United States. So this is what the president did not want.
Mm-hmm.
So while it looks pretty terrible what he did, the alternative, we should talk about that too.
Yeah.
What would have happened if the Germans had used their invasion boats and their navy and used the British Navy and they to escort troops over to this country?
Yeah, that would have been a horrible battle.
That was really what this was all about.
Yeah, they were looking far ahead, weren't they?
Well, yeah, so because, Germany had conquered most of Europe and were about to conquer the British Isles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is what worried President Roosevelt.
Yeah. When they, after the attack on Pearl Harbor and the death of all the folks, they had hearings. And at those hearings, I think it was 1946, I think it was. I'm not sure. 1946, I think you said in your book. Boy, Kimmel and Short, boy, they took it, didn't they? They really got hammered, those two guys.
Oh, yes. Well, that was a joint investigation by Congress, both the Senate and the House of Representatives. They started in November 1945 and continued to 1946.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just a rigged investigation,
all of them
have been since, from the 9/11 and even the current on the Benghazi problems. They don't bring in the actual intercepts. Those are too damaging.
Yeah,
their proper.
Yeah, they definitely don't bring in. They don't bring in the real stuff. And as you said in your book, it's just horrible what happened and the death and destruction of the sailors in Pearl Harbor. Just horrible. My mother had a boyfriend that was in the Navy, and he was killed at Pearl Harbor. And so that touched a lot of people in this country. I can see where, that would bring the emotions high to get involved in World War II against the Japanese. And you're right, if the Germans had beaten England, they would have definitely had a big fleet if the British hadn't gone ahead and destroyed all their ships, But they would have been just a horrible. Things would have been really horrible, really horrible.
The Germany and the Axis nations could have pulled that off in 1940 mm-hmm. or 1941 mm-hmm. because our navy was we were not set for a two ocean navy at that time.
Right.
We didn't get it until about the late 1943. That's when we went after Japan.
Right.
But didn't we chase the Graf Spee across the Atlantic and they scuttled it in South America someplace?
Yes, that is right. That still didn't unite this country. This country, 80% did not want anything to do with the Europe's war that we talked about earlier.
They sure didn't. They remembered, Mr. Stinnett, they remembered World War One.
That's right.
They
were
remembering World War One, and so they weren't going to... when you were we're just about out of time, and I'm really sorry. You were writing this book and getting the information on it, did you get a lot, and after it was published, did you get a lot of pushback from the Navy veterans?
Oh, I have about a 70% approval rating on the book, and there's 30% of people don't accept the McCollum's overt act of war proposal,
mm-hmm.
but I think the 70% is
that's pretty good
to the documentation.
Yeah, that's pretty good because you, Mr. Stinnett, you really footnote this thing. I mean, everything you've said in it, I mean, everything you got from Freedom of Information and everything you wrote down here, you can back it up.
Every one of your listeners can see it also at National Archives in Washington.
Yeah. Is there anything you'd like to say before we have to cut this off?
Well, I'm glad that we talked about the fact that all of our modern ships, all our aircraft carriers and their supporting vessels were out of Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Damaged.
Yeah.
And they turned around and we had this great victory at mm-hmm. Midway 6 months later, which really knocked out the Japanese air operations.
Yeah, yeah.
I heard that there was a Japanese submarine that had got into the into Pearl Harbor. Is that correct? Or
There were five Japanese midget submarines.
Yeah.
Four of them entered the Pearl Harbor waters, and then one went around onto the windward side of Pearl Harbor, but they were all sunk.
Oh, boy. Mr. Stinnett, we're just out of time here, and I really want to thank you for coming on and talking about this, and I'm glad that you wrote this book, and I hope that a lot of people read it, and I hope you have a really good day, and again, thank you very much for coming on our show.
Yes, thank you very much.
My pleasure, and I thank you for the invitation.
Okay, thanks, buddy. That was Robert B. Stinnett. He's the author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. I got the book at Powell's. They had one left. You can go on the internet. I think you can read it on the internet. I'm not really sure. But he has everything documented. Everything he said is true, you know. And it's really, really interesting. I had a lot of feedback from some people, you know. Some, like he's saying, most of them, everybody's agreed with it, you know. They said, this probably happened. And then there was just a few said, oh, no, he's not telling the truth. And, you know, the U.S. would never do anything like that. You know, then I said, Gulf of Tonkin, USS Maine, you know, weapons of mass destruction and stuff like that.
So, 9-11.
9-11. So I'm hoping that people will go on and read the book. And we can use this as a learning that they do lie to us. They do lie to us. And I'm really, my heart goes out to everybody that was killed in Hawaii on those ships and the civilians and everything that happened. And it, you know, like John Lennon said, you know, war is over if you want it. And we have to really start working on that and keep going at it. And every veteran out there should talk about it. And there's a lot of these new veterans coming up that don't get it yet, but they will get it.
And
they will get it.
They just passed a monstrous defense bill that uses up more of your tax dollars than any other program that we have in this country.
57% of all of our money goes into war. Of discretionary money goes into war. So we got a real problem that we need to really work on. And we will be back on January 17th at 9 a.m. And I'm pretty sure Arlene will be, hopefully Arlene will be back.
The snow will be gone.
Yeah, we miss her and I wish she was here. And so we'll see you next month. And thanks for listening. And I hope you read the book, A Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. And thank you. Thank you, Tammy. Thank you, Tammy. And
our wonderful engineer, Tammy. And she's smiling at us.
And we'll be back next month. Bye.
Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the Little Big Horn. I heard many.
Proud to help co-sponsor the Triangle production of American Fiesta, starring Gary Wayne Cash, a witty, hopeful tale of imperfection and acceptance. American Fiesta will take place at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. This Triangle production will run from November 29th through December 22nd. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm, on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday, December 20th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Just a few headlines before we go into our featured interview with Michael Ratner on revelations yesterday that came out by retired Major General Leonard, the commanding officer, the first commanding officer at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, the man responsible for setting up the original dog cages in which people were contained. We have an interview with him to play for you, and I would like to, doubt if we'll get to it, but I have excerpts from a book by Mozambique, it came out in 2006, Enemy Combatant, which I commend your attention to. It is an extraordinary document, as testimony to what the human beings are capable of doing to one another. And it's an indictment of the entire U.S. system of justice. We'll put that on the website. Headlines from around Cascadia. First, though, most chicken sold in stores is contaminated, according to Consumer Reports. Contaminated with what? Well, you just wait and see. Salmonella, for one thing, but that's just for starters. And federal regulators want to overturn the state of Oregon's program for reducing coastal pollution runoff caused by what? Wait for it. Logging. Of course, that's what it's caused by. And yet our legislators are charging full speed ahead up the mountain and down the other side, clear-cutting as they go. Clackamas County is the recipient of Federal Emergency Management Agency money. That's going to be